The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Friday, the 18th of June, 2021. On the podcast today, Michael Masterman, chairman of W Resources, talks about the completed construction of a 500,000 meter cubic dam at La Perilla, which enables them to proceed with full-scale dewatering of the pit mine. Plus, Russ Mould, investment director at stockbroker AJ Bell, talks about the recent UK IPOs and their pitfalls. Plus, Dan Lane, senior analyst at Free Trade, discusses inflation. Plus, news from Best of the Best, Boohoo, Creo Medical, and GB Group. And as always, at the end of the podcast, I have two lists for you. The top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most read RNSs. You can check out both these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk, where you'll also see lots of other content. In fact, new video right there with N Plus One singer, chief economist, Jamie Constable, chatting to Paul Hill in his June update. Also, European Metal Holdings moves to expand its presence in the US. There's one there on Zinwald Lithium as well. Zach is there, Bulletin Board Heroes. What's he looking at? A similar group, Odie Boom, Duke Mont Capital, Gunsin, Codal, Mode, Neuformix, Open Orphan, Thangela, and Novasite. And, of course, on the front page of Vox Markets there, you can see the COVID-19 index. Biggest rise of the day, Novasite up 10%. Biggest faller, Omega Diagnostics, down 3.3% to 58.5%. Check that out at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Vox Markets is an online community of investors that runs a free mobile and desktop platform that allows you to track news and updates about any UK-listed company, offering RNS push notifications, detailed charts, pricing data, and much more. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Michael Masterman, chairman of W Resources, WRES. Michael, thanks for coming on the podcast. Long time no speak.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic to be back on again, Justin.
Yeah, and what a year. I mean, I think, you know, looking back at it, trying to find out when we last spoke, but what a year it's been. And I think we last spoke in April, actually, 2020, which was pretty much the start of, of COVID. And now here we are a year later, more than a year later, and we're still dealing with the aftermath of COVID. And but before we get into whether it's affected you and how it's affected you in any way, just give us a brief overview, Michael, for people not familiar with W Resources, what you're all about, please.
Okay, so W Resources, WRES is the ticker on the AIM. We're a tungsten and tin company focused on mining with an operating mine in Spain, La Perilla, and development tungsten mines in Spain and Portugal.
Excellent stuff. Okay. Well, your last bit of news is, and we need some backstory on this, of course, for people not familiar, completion of a 500,000-meter-cube dam. So explain why that's needed and what's happening there, because you raised some money for that, didn't you, I think?
Yeah, look, 2020 was probably better thought about as what doesn't kill us makes us stronger.
Yeah,
we went into 2021 with really good shutdown on La Perilla. We were ready to go with materially higher production level production levels and recovery levels through the La Perilla plant, but we hit a constraint because there was very heavy rains in February, March, and that led to a rise in the water levels in the mining pit, which constrained us and, frustratingly constrained us for the last 2 months, in particular April and May, because we were constrained in accessing the good grade, high grade tin, high grade tungsten ore that we need in volume to significantly increase the production rate to La Perilla. So we did a capital raise. Principal use of funds was to quickly build a dam, which we've finished, and we're now pumping the water out of the mining pit and enabling access to the mining ore that we're planning to mine. And yeah, look, as we go into the second half of the year, I think we're going to have a really good run.
Yeah, yeah, okay, cool. And so explain exactly where you are right now then, and how are things impacting, I mean, and also not just, you know, the water, but COVID and all that stuff. Where you are at the moment, how is production there?
So we, through the last couple of months where we've been, let's call it water constrained, we've been mining, been processing, but we've been on a kind of like a 4-5 day a week schedule because, you know, the ore feed to the plant's been limited. What the completion of the water dams, you know, very large in size, 500,000 cubic meters, allows us to do is it allows us to quickly move the water from the mine pit, dewater the mine pit, and start accessing the benches that we know from our grade controlled drilling have great grades of tin, great grades of tungsten. And when we feed that into the plant, we'll be able to move to 7-day operation, and we'll be able to use those high grades to materially increase production rates. Yeah.
And I mean, first of all, let's talk about the commodity prices. Cause, how are they looking?
Oh, look, tin is exceptionally strong. Tin's gone from about 16,000 a ton to now 32,000 a ton. Yeah, it's effectively doubled. Importantly, we've actually increased it. Originally, the mine was meant to produce about 10% tin and 90% tungsten, but the grades of tin have been running very well, and we've been up around the 25% tin, 75% tungsten. So we're following tin strongly. Tungsten's gone from kind of like the low 200s per MTU to pretty close to cracking 300 per MTU. Tin always is the slow achiever in a commodity run. Tends to lag about 6 months behind the rest of the industrial metals complex for some very good reasons. But all the fundamentals are there. There's not much tin around, particularly in Europe and the United States, and we're expecting very strong performance from tin through the back end of 2021.
Yeah. And is there any way you can sort of project then sort of, you know, what you hope to be producing, you know, cash flow terms?
At design capacity, at probably lower commodity prices in our feasibility study in the associated document that went to the AIM, we were looking about 20 million EBITDA at design capacity. So we've got our eyes set on being able to, you know, deliver that kind of level into 2022, and we'll certainly use the next 6 months to get up to that kind of run rate. The commodity prices we used, I think we'll end up exceeding as we go through the back end of this year. We've got a lot of work to do, but we've got a really good team. Really importantly, we raised money to remove the constraint of the water, and we've done that. That opens up a great opportunity to deliver on production and cash flow through the back end of 2021.
Yeah, and just to put that in context, it's 20K of EBITDA. Your current market cap is, what, sub 9 million, is that correct?
Yeah, no, 9 million pounds, that is. But, yeah. We've certainly got some, there's huge potential. We've got some debt, but, you know, we've got a great opportunity as we go into stronger and stronger cash flow to refinance that down to lower interest rates. And we're quietly confident in a very, very strong commodity market that will be able to come out the back end of 2021 in exceptionally strong condition.
Yeah, well, it's like you said there, you know. I mean, 2020, like you said, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And like I say, it's been very challenging, but you've now seemingly got over those hurdles, and it's onward and upward, isn't it?
Yeah, look, we brought in some really good institutional investors in the last raising. I've kind of now, with this announcement out, I'm now clear of closed period. So, what I said I'd put in back then will come in. And, I think touch wood, we're going to have a really good 2021.
Yeah, excellent stuff. Okay, I know it's been over a year, but I'm sure you haven't forgot this part of the podcast where I ask for three reasons. If someone's listening to this, likes the sound of what you're talking about here, Michael, but are not yet following the story, give them those three quick reasons to add W Resources to their watch list, please, if you could.
We're a tin and tungsten company. Tin prices are exceptionally strong. Tungsten's getting stronger every day. We've removed the major constraint on significantly increasing our tin production and our tungsten production, and that's going to allow us to significantly increase production and therefore revenue. We have a large, low-cost ore body that can deliver significant returns to shareholders.
Yeah, and you own a decent chunk of shares as well, don't you?
I do.
That's always, whenever I look at companies, that's one of the things I look at straight away is whether the management have skin in the game. And so that's definitely a positive factor for people doing research. Michael, thanks very much for that. And like I say now, onward and upward, hopefully we'll speak again in the not too distant future. Thanks very much.
Okay, great to talk, Justin. Bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Russ Mould, Investment Director at Stockbroker AJ Bell. You're Russ?
Yeah, very well, thank you. Though a bit hot, a bit bothered in Brighton because it's sticky. It's like Singapore here at the minute. It's very unusual. We normally get that lovely sea breeze, but it's not. I know it's a first world problem. There are a lot worse things are going on. The weather at the start of the weather of the week was beautiful, and now it's just like, oh, this is grim.
But it's one of those things, Britain is a bit of extremes. I was looking at the weather there, and literally all this week, at the start of the week, it was looking glorious. Mm. But there was a little patch. They said, you may have a chance of a thunderstorm on Wednesday night. And I thought, hang on, Wednesday night? No, it's been Thursday and Friday, raining non-stop, and then there's no sign of sun for the rest of the week. What's happened there?
Yeah, I know. It's bizarre, isn't it?
There we go.
It really is. It is weird. So, yeah, but our daughter got her debut cricket match in for her new team last night, which is very good. But the forecast for the rest of the weekend is looking, I'd imagine there's a few farmers there, barbecue's looking a bit dodgy as well on Sunday at the moment, so we'll see how it goes.
Yeah. And,
anyway.
There we go. And, talking about sort of raining on people's parades, you just alerted me to, and it's good weather for Dr. Martin's, but their IPO.
It is.
What are the IPO, I'm looking at the chart here.
Been
was
very
it in January?
Went very well.
When was it?
Right at the start of the year.
January the 29th. That's right. I'm looking here. It went from £4, I think. Went up to sort of £5.10, trading in a range there between £4.50 and £5.10. And yesterday, it's dropped back to that IPO price pretty much. What's going on here?
Well, it's just one of those things. I mean, the outlook statement was fine. The sort of underlying results were pretty much what they're leading people to expect. But they did say, as we said on page 187 of the prospectus, we're paying out a very substantial bonus to all of our staff members. So the stated profits are not what you were expecting. Very sorry. So people initially took a bit of umbrage to that. It was in the prospectus. The company had done what it needed to do. But that understandably perhaps didn't play terribly well. And I think it's intriguing with IPOs because we are seeing a few more. We've had a bit of a run of them recently. We've got Wise coming up, which is
Do you know what? I go back to that. That's a prospectus remark there. I mean, that's amazing. 186 the page number.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, how many people make it past page one? I think you've probably
many,
counted
probably.
On your single hand, including the broker himself.
I think this is the warning. I'm not knocking Doc Martin. It was all there. It was all disclosed. It's all legally tight. I think what's in, the question, I mean, we've had, I think, sort of between 40 and 50 IPOs in the UK this year now. And if anything, the UK is probably getting brickbats for not having more.
Yeah.
And those that it's had, because there's always the accusation that companies are going to other domiciles, whether it's America or possibly Asia or Frankfurt or Amsterdam.
Yeah.
So there's that knock. The knock has also been that, some of the things that have happened, like Deliveroo and Alpha Wave IP, haven't gone very well. And so you had the Hill Review saying, well, we should basically ease the listing rules. And, you know, we should allow more SPACs, and we should, and one thing I do agree with, we should make it easier for retail investors to get involved, which I think is great. But again, the caveat to that is, if retail investors do want to get involved in IPO, then they probably do have to read to page and
exactly
the prospectus. And that's, that is a matter that everybody needs to be aware of. These things are not free, they don't represent free money. Now, that said, until, I mean, I last updated my table a couple of days ago because I had yesterday off. But of the 40-odd IPOs that came up, have come, the average gain from IPO price has still been more than 20%. Now, for retail investors, getting in at IPO prices, we've discussed, is not easy. Mm-hmm. So you're probably looking at the sort of the price on first open, which is where the rewards will be less. But I think those deals that have got out generally have therefore been well policed by fund managers and by investors.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the old Buffett rule, rule number one, don't lose money. Rule number two, don't forget rule number one. And I think what you can say is that if you do give your money to a fund manager, say, and they get the first crack at these IPOs, their job is not to lose your money to start with. And so you can argue that by giving these few IPOs the cold shoulder, by not letting some come to market, or by demanding a relatively attractive valuation, they're doing what they're paid to do, which is protecting customers' money. So I don't think that necessarily that the UK isn't seeing millions of IPOs is a bad thing. I mean, I don't think you should measure success of a stock exchange by the number of deals that get done, because that's how you do get into deep waters with, you know, bubbles and duff IPOs coming through. And I think we are at that stage of the cycle. If you talk to fund managers, let's face it, markets are pretty much an all-time high. You are seeing some, you know, you saw the Marex Spectrum deal that didn't get done. And I think one of the things that fell on was it was a commodities broker. The Bloomberg Commodities Index was at an all-time high. They weren't raising money, and it was just shareholders selling out. And so the first question is, well, if they're selling and they're a commodities broker, they know the business better than anybody else, why should I be buying? Is the first question. And that's the same with any investment is, whether you're just buying a share in the open market. Well, if I'm being so smart buying, why are they being so dumb selling? A question that you genuinely need to ask yourself. And what do I know that the seller doesn't, or what? And you may well know something legally, of course, that the other person doesn't know, or have an intuition that the other person doesn't have. But it doesn't mean that, you know, just because the share is there to buy, you necessarily have to do so. So I think with IPOs, we're at that stage in the cycle where markets are an all-time high. You are seeing some deals now where there's no money being raised, and it's just much more existing holders selling down. So again, you need to wonder why that might be. And I think just generally speaking, you know, Charlie Munger, Buffett's long-term business partner, you know, drew up a little list of four checks that uses any company to analyze any company. And they apply to IPOs just as they much to existing listed companies. If anything, even more so, because, you know, again, lots of fund managers don't like IPOs. You only get 2 or 3 weeks to make a decision. Yeah. You might get to meet the management team once. There's a limited trading history. So you're definitely taking a lot more on trust than you would do normally. That's not necessarily a bad thing, but it needs to be reflected in the valuation that you pay. And that's why IPOs will generally come at a discount to the established quoted peers, just because there's a few more unknowns out there. This checklist, you know, do I understand the business?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if the answer is no, then what do? You just walk away, right?
Yep.
Does the business have intrinsic value? Does it have a strong competitive position when it's in an industry? And what are the threats? Is it regulation? Is it technological change? Is it competition? Mm-hmm. Do I trust the management team? Now, you know, clearly with Deliveroo, people weren't happy with a dual share structure. They were happy with that with Matt Moulding at THG Group, interestingly. They're going to have another think about it with Wise. And in America, that seems to be a lot less of a problem. The Hill Review said it would be a good thing over here. Personally, don't agree. And then the most important thing of all, does the company come at a fair price? Doesn't have to come at a bargain basement level, but you probably need it to come at a discount to its established peers because less trading history, less visibility, less time to kick the tires. And then it's a matter of what is the appropriate metric for that, whether it's yield or price to book value or earnings or whatever. And if the company doesn't tick one of those boxes, you probably need to start thinking, am I just giving into fear of missing out here? Does it fit with my overall strategy, my overall portfolio profile, my appetite for risk? If the answer is no, move on. And you might miss out on something, but you might not. And at least, yes, this year, the overall gains have been good, but, you know, they've been held back by one or two fairly big disasters. And again, they were ones that on valuation grounds or governance grounds, you can argue were probably relatively easy to spot, and that's why they didn't fly in the first place.
Yeah, no, I agree with that time thing. I always think the market, there's always, you know, paying a good price is always the thing. There's no point chasing prices, and that's and when IPOs come to the market, you know, part of the job is to market it like it's, you know, you've got to get in, you know, to create that interest in the stock. And so I've had people say to me, "Oh, this IPO is coming up, and they've known a company that's come up. Should I get in?" I said, "Wait, you know, you got to play. The market always offers opportunities. There's always sell-offs, you know, general sell-offs, and that may be a couple months down the line. But by then, hopefully, they'll have some trading updates out or something, and you can make a better decision." You know? So I never rush into IPOs. I can't remember the last IPO I did, but I mean, long time ago.
Why. And lots of fund managers are the same. You know, and obviously, and having been a fund manager and being a broker on the institutional side, you know, I know what it's like. I mean, there's nothing. Malicious goes on, but you know there is pressure put on fund managers. You know, if you take this deal, you'll get a good allocation in the next deal. There's a hot one coming around the corner, and all that sort of stuff goes on. And you often find that fund managers take a deal a bit reluctantly, and then it starts going wrong, and they quickly dump it, and the thing goes through the floorboards. So you know, again, there's a lot of there's no right answer to how to price an IPO. And again, I've done it. I've looked at it as a fund manager. I've looked at it as a broker involved in floats, and I've looked at it in my current job and as a journalist. And there is no right answer, because you're trying to balance the desires of the seller, the money that the company perhaps wishes to raise, match that with the needs of the buyer, which is obviously they want to pay the lowest price they can get away with. And also you want to make sure after all of that, there is a stable aftermarket where there's demand and the share price, it doesn't have to go up in a straight line. If anything, we always view that as unhelpful. What you don't want is the thing to go down in a straight line, because it takes a long time for the company's reputation to recover from that, even if it's done nothing wrong. You know, Deliveroo's share price is now sort of stuck around £2.50, and people are now just waiting to see if it can, well, deliver what it promised, if you pardon the expression, and see how that goes. But I think if you do get a flop, it can take a long time to shake off that stigma. Now, equally, you've just said you don't chase them, you wait for the bad news. Maybe that's the time when you should be really doing your homework on these things. So have a look at it. See if it's delivering, the valuation's down from where it was. And it's the old Templeton thing. You know, people say to him, where's it looking good right now? And he says, I'm never interested in that. I'm looking where it's looking bad, because that's where the best valuations are and the best bargains are to be had.
Yeah. What's this? I've not heard of Wise. You mentioned it.
It used to be TransferWise. It's another fintech company. It's money transfers.
Okay, yeah. And so they're planning...
It's going to come with quite a big price tag as well. Anything between £5 and £9 billion, you can drive a coach and horses through that, which shows you again how hard it is to get the price right for these things. The valuation has gone up quite a lot in the last year, which again, it did for Deliveroo, for example. And so the first question the investors want to know is, well, why is it worth X% more than it was a year ago? What's happened in the meantime? Apart from that, some of the US comps have gone up a lot.
Yeah.
Which, again, may be why the company's deciding, and its backers are thinking now might be quite a good time to knock a few out, in which case, if they think it's a good time to knock a few out, you've got to have a very, very good reason for why you should be the one on the other end of the trade. I'm not saying it's the wrong thing to do. Again, I need to read the prospectus all the way through to page 100 and whatever it is, and you need to have a view on those facets plus in the end evaluation.
It's funny you mentioned that. On my profile picture on Twitter, I got a quote there that says, one of the funny things about the stock market is that every time one person buys, another sells, and both think they're astute.
And it's absolutely right. You've got to have a good reason for why you're pressing that button or swiping that key, because, you know, there's somebody on the other side thinking that they're smarter than you are.
Doesn't mean they are, but
you've got to have a good reason for doing it, not just, oh, I fancy it because it's Friday morning, I'll have a latch at that. Then you're guessing, and guessing is eventually going to get you into trouble.
I was looking at a Financial Times article on Wise here, and they mentioned Deliveroo, and it's described as the worst IPO in London's history. I'm looking at the chart about Deliveroo. It hasn't recovered. I mean, it listed it opened at 3.31. It's now 2.54, and it's just gone. It fell down to that level and just gone sideways for a while. And I think the problem there is they've not stated any time where they're going to be profitable. Is that the case? I think
that is correct. Yeah, and in fact, Will Shu said he didn't care. Which, again, to me was just like, well, or worse, maybe I'm putting words in his mouth, so I should be careful. But it certainly wasn't their immediate priority.
How do you generate value from that? I don't understand why.
Well, I think it's really hard, because in the end, if a company doesn't generate cash, it's very hard to see what value it has at all. Now, he will say we're in a massive customer land grab right now. we will get those customers in, we will get them loyal, we will sell them more services, and in future we will monetize that. And that will be the argument. But at the moment, the problem that you have is that money is so plentiful and so cheap, the range and ability of competitors to turn up and make a proper nuisance of themselves is enormous. And I think one of the things that I find concerning about record low interest rates and quantitative easing is that, yes, central banks may be saying we're helping businesses borrow, get credit cheaply and invest and grow. But if those businesses are only making economic sense when interest rates are at zero, what sort of business are they in the first place? In my opinion, a very good one.
Yeah, no, and I'm trying to see in their trading update if they mention, did they mention loss? I mean, delivery room talking about, they talk about, you know, the revenue, all that stuff. They don't think they mention anything about...
They talk about revenue and customer acquisition generally.
That's it. But they don't mention anything about how much they're losing. So they,
that's all a bit, I mean, which again, for me, is all a bit bull market. Because again, I don't want to sound like a dinosaur, but this is exactly what you saw in 1999, 2000, 2001. Hmm. It's what you saw with the commodity stocks in 2006, 2007, and... There is that slight sense of history starting to rhyme a little bit more. So again, just be a little. I mean, the good news is we've only had 40 or 50 IPOs in London this year, not 400. You know, so I think when you see, I think the thing now to be aware of is what you really don't want to see, and I stress this with regard to, say, a stock like Deliveroo, where the IPO has not gone well. If the lockup expires in 180 days, which in Deliveroo's case will make it basically September, October, if the backers then say, actually, we're going to sell a load more anyway, at, say, £2.50, for me, that's a massive red flag. Yeah. Because don't forget, they're in an awful lot earlier. They didn't pay £3.31 for their stock, right? Their venture capital private equity backers, they're in way back. Frankly, most prices for them are a profit. And if they're sellers at £2.54, £2.25, £200, and they're still in, then you think, well, hang on a minute, I don't want to be touching this with a 10-foot pole. So I think that'll be a really, really interesting test come the autumn when the lockups expire, what the attitude is of the backers. If they still hit the eject button, then I think that's telling you what they think of the valuation and you probably need to be taking evasive action.
Yeah, yeah. Now, do you know what? I've just literally did a search for the word loss on their trading update. Nothing there. I mean, the first line is growth accelerated. This is Q1 for the fourth consecutive quarter with group orders up 114% year-on-year to 71 million and GTV up 130% year-on-year to 1.65 billion. So they're turning over, but they could be burning 2 billion. You don't know how much they're burning.
It's a phrase I've read in a few blogs in the States. It's profitless prosperity.
Yeah.
And in the end, I mean, the good thing is for them, the money's so cheap, people are throwing it at them. They can burn up that money for a long time and not get into any financial difficulty. But if you're not in the end going to generate cash, it's really hard to see, to put a genuine valuation on the equity. And at some stage, you do need to see some. And, you know, again, supported Deliveroo will say, well, look at Amazon. Didn't generate money for a heck of a long time, and now it's an absolute monster. And that's the model that people look at. But how many Amazons are out there?
Yeah.
Not many.
No, and that guy, Jeff Bezos, is a special character. In fact, do you know what? I retweeted one of the first TV interviews he did about the internet, and he's like a encyclopedia of stats. And about he started to launch the books, and he was explaining why they went for books. And fair play. He's almost like a talking spreadsheet. And I thought, wow, that guy's amazing. But I think with any market where the prices move a lot, if you go into any market, like you mentioned the Middle Eastern markets or anywhere there where the prices move and you have a haggle, you've always got to try and get a good deal. Always. Even with stocks, you know, you go try and get a good deal. Yeah. Never just chase prices for the sake of it because it's a hot stock. Try and think, if I bought this now in this market, can I quite easily, you know, sell it, you know, for the money I got for it, or maybe a bit higher if possible, you know, and just on intrinsic value alone, you know? So, it's always worth trying to get a good deal, isn't it, you know?
It is.
Mm-hmm. Marvellous stuff, Russ. Thanks for that.
Pleasure. Enjoy your weekend.
Yes, well, I'll try to. I'll put my Dr. Martens on and 25 holers, I think, with this weather. It's dreadful. In fact, do you know what? They're quite popular, obviously, but I've never had, since I was a kid, I've never had Dr. Martens.
I've got a pair of cherry reds, actually. I wear them at the football in winter. Keep my feet lovely and warm. Yeah. I'm a fan, actually. But I must admit, my pair are good. 10 or 12 years old. They've been very hard wearing, so I suppose at some stage they might spring a league, but they've been brilliant so far, I have to say.
Yeah, that's a problem. Maybe they're too good. You need recurring revenue.
There's a story there.
Yeah. Marvellous. Cheers, I'll speak next week.
Okay.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Dan Lane, Senior Analyst with Free Trade. You're right, Dan.
Hiya, Justin.
Now, I know the Fed was out yesterday saying that they're going to continue to help stimulate the economy if it needs it, even though we're coming out of a pandemic. They did mention, I think, they're going to start to look at raising rates, interest rates, in 2023. And there is this, they said it's transitory. You know, the inflation, is it or isn't it? I don't know how they know that, really. I think they're just trying to say that it's almost like they're trying to say the right thing, you know? And I think, how do they actually know it's transitory, you know? Because in the UK, we've suffered a bit of inflation. I mean, a big jump.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know what? It's nearly like they're trying to say, guys, we've seen the future. Don't worry, it turns out okay. You know, it's not, but at the other side, you know, I can't really blame them for trying to be a little bit measured on this. You know, if you think about the comparative measures from last year, this was such an extraordinary year. Trying to get any sense out of this, especially as economists trying to out of the data, you know, it's a hard job for them. And I think maybe the message they want to see is, guys, we just need to write this year off. You know, we don't see this continuing. But as you say, if they keep on saying, you know, this is just transitory, people start to think, okay, well, we've heard that. What are you going to do? What are we saying here? Mm-hmm. And I think raising rates, it was always on the cards. Even before the pandemic, we were talking about we can't stay at record low rates forever. Mm-hmm. The fact that, you know, raising rates is probably going to come back in the next few years, it shouldn't really be alarm bells to anyone. This might have been the trigger, but it was always kind of in the plans. So I think people are getting in there, you know, themselves in a twist about this. I don't think it's something that we really need to concern ourselves with. Yeah. It's not a terrible thing for stock markets in the beginning of a rate rise anyway.
Yeah, yeah. And like I said, they don't want to whack him up like 2% or something. It's going to be a quarter of a percentage point. And do you know what? So trying to say the right thing. I don't know if you saw this yesterday, but best of the best. And I've never been in the stock at all, but I know a couple of people on Twitter have talked about it, and basically they run competitions online to win cars, other prizes. I think they have some of those cars as well in airports and all that stuff, you know, where you can take part in a raffle maybe. But the results came out, and if you glance at them, they're not too bad. Revenue increased to 45 million from 17 million. Profit before tax 14 from 4 million. And this is obviously the year ended 30th of April. And you scroll down, it all seems fine, you know, proposed dividend, special dividend, all this stuff. And you look at the chief executive's statement there, all, you know, three paragraphs of a statement in the highlights here. And then, on the second sentence of the third paragraph, you think, however, uh-oh, here we go, what's happening here? And so that word, however, this is when shareholders are smiling till here, and they go, what? Hang on a sec. It says, in contrast to the summer 2020 period, we've experienced somewhat of a reduction in customer engagement since the latest easing of lockdown restrictions on April the 12th, specifically relating to the, understandably, long-awaited reopening of hospitality and non-essential retail. We're closely monitoring this, but with our flexible model, growth strategy and plans for the year ahead, we expect the consumer engagement to return to normal levels before too long. So there's that, however, it's almost tucked in right at the, you know, last sort of sentence pretty much of the statement. And you think, well, what's the options there? If he'd been upfront about this, the share price would have dropped. They try to tuck it away here. The share price went down by 28% anyway. So it's like, you think sometimes, maybe you just, you know, put it up there somewhere, because these results are to the year ended the 30th of April, 2021. So they're now saying they're not seeing engagement in this month, so that, as yet, though, they don't know when it's going to return. They say they think it will return, so it's dropped off a bit of a cliff. But I mean, it's always tricky. That's why never just go off, you know, try and read as much as you can, I think. I think the lesson here is try and read as much as you can, you know, if you're invested in a company, because the stuff they want you to see is up front, isn't it? You know, it's like when you're searching for a house and you look online, it's almost, I always say, you know, it's what the estate agents don't put in the front window there, don't put on the highlights, is what you have to look for. They say everything's great, and all of a sudden they say, hang on, they don't mention a garden. It hasn't got a garden. That's why. And it's almost like, you know, you look, when you're looking through these things, you've got to look for, what are they not saying? Or what are they trying to hide, isn't it, you know? What's the ugly bit?
Exactly. Do you know, exactly. And do you know what? Like we said, given last year, I don't think anyone's going to, you know, really get on the business or, you know, put them down for not having performed as much as they would like. But in all of this, what you really need, what kind of Maslow's hierarchy on the bottom, you need dependable management who you don't think is going to pull the wool over your eyes. And this kind of feels a little bit like that. They haven't lied, but they've obfuscated kind of the truth. It reminds me of all these RNSs that come out, and they always start with, you know, we are pleased to announce, and then it's not actually great results.
I'm always skeptical as well of companies who put adjectives, really hyper, you know, hyped up adjectives in the title of the RNS, you know, exceptional, or I think, well, calm down. First of all, you're hoping people just read the, in this day and age, of course, with social media, most people just do read the highlights, but they're hoping to get away with that. So I'm always skeptical of that, adjectives in RNSs, headlines. But talking about that, right, you know, questionable management. I know the management of the next company you want to talk about has been questioned quite a few times on their policies and their Labour policies, and that's Boohoo. But how were their results? Because didn't react too much on the chart of late, but it seemed okay. I think it didn't drop.
Yeah, I mean, listen, Boohoo, they're just strength to strength here. You know, group sales up over 30%, margins still above 50%, super strong. I think, you know, Boohoo's had a fantastic year. We're all shopping online. It's small ticket items. It's not the thing. You know, I think we spoke about Ted Baker about, you know, these big expensive items that we're not buying. Boohoo doesn't have any of that. It's all kind of, if you buy it for 10 or 15 quid, well, that's fine. Wear it once, whatever. But I think, as you said, there's a couple of things that we need to think about with Boohoo. One is these ESG concerns. You know, this modern slavery investigation and, you know, these recommendations that they've had to implement. To be fair to them, the management has implemented, I think, 20 of the 34 recommendations from this independent audit. So, you know, they're on their way. But, you know, is this something that's just hanging over the group now? As well as I was thinking about, I was chatting to one of the analysts at Free Trade there, is Boohoo really a clothes as a fashion house anymore, or is it an online platform? Mm-hmm. Is it changing its strategy with all of these new brands and kind of the Debenhams architecture on board? It'll be interesting to see how it turns out.
Yeah. And the odd thing was here, I mean, if you look at online fashion and these people like ASOS and, you know, Palm High and sell them quickly, just, you know, low margins. Boohoo's margins weren't low compared to everything else. And they're thinking, why is that? Well, how come their margins are so much bigger than most other online retailers who sell a lot of in volume, you know, volume-wise? And you think, well, they've got to be paying someone, you know, the costs are low. Why are the costs low? And that to me is red flags. You're thinking, well, you must be paying people, you know, unless you've got some kind of super special model or you've got some magic there. How are your costs low compared to your competitors and your peers, you know? Because they aren't, you know, it's not as if they're the only people in the market. So it's a very competitive space, you know? So, very interesting there. And,
I mean, we've just got a new analyst started at Free Trade there who's from the ex-retail space, who was telling me that last year on Black Friday, Boohoo's brand Pretty Little Thing were selling a dress for 8p.
8p?
And you have to think, how are you? Yeah. I only got the 10 of them, don't worry. But these prices are questionable. They really are. And with these ESG concerns in the background, investors might be a little bit more nervous now.
Yeah. It's funny. I was reading, I did cover sort of a top line on this, that people are now buying dresses to go out rather than leisure wear, as they call it. It's a change. Hopefully people can unlock. But it's interesting to see. I mean, there's another one who's, I watched a documentary on BBC Three about young guys who set up a similar kind of brand. I can't think what it's called now, but they've just listed it. I can't think of what it's called, but their growth is very good as well. So it's a space that's, you know, being dominated, and they use like celebrities on Instagram and all that stuff. That's one of their main drivers for growth, you know. And they recently listed, I can't think what they're called now, but there's a documentary on BBC Three, and I watched it. It was very interesting because they went from nothing to doing very, very well. But yeah, like I said, it's a very competitive space, and Let's see, it's always changing. Cool. What's any other companies out there, Dan, you're looking at?
Yeah, I just thought it would be interesting. Creo Medical, I've had a look at them for a while, actually. They have this, they're very different from Boohoo. We're really going the other end of the spectrum on the smaller company front. They have a product called Microblate, and what it is it's kind of the same size as the kind of standard biopsy needle used in medical practice, but it uses a very high-frequency microwave. And apparently, it lends physicians a lot of accuracy, and it was trialed before Christmas, positive trials. Share price shot up late in 2020 because of that, and it's just got they've just reported that the first successful use in human use to kind of cut round pancreatic tumor. Last year we all kind of flocked to healthcare because of COVID. And everyone said that trade is done, but actually there's trades like this that were nothing to do with COVID, but have such implications for the medical field that we can't really just forget the medical sector as soon as the excitement about COVID dies down. This is probably one of the ones that seems most exciting coming out of the UK.
So what's it called? Microblate, is that right?
Microblate Fine, I think, is the instrument, but from Creo, yeah.
Okay, and I look into that. It's a lot bigger than I normally look at. What is it? 260 million market cap run about there, I think.
Yeah. I mean, we're not talking a huge company here. And I think maybe one of the risks investors have is that's maybe their flagship product, and they're kind of pinning all their hopes on it. So this is what you get in the smaller company space. But if there's an increased accuracy there, it's kind of the opposite to what the growth in the healthcare industry has been in terms of these single use repeatable products. Maybe I think about Stryker in America, who make these kind of syringes that lock as soon as you use them, so you can't use them again. Surgeons and physicians have to go out and get a new one. That's quite a good revenue stream. And then you've got the other side where Creo is just super innovative.
Yeah. I'm just looking at their final results there. So they're valued at 260 million, if that's right there, the shares an issue. Total sales for the period, this is the 31st December, 9.4 million. Cash and equivalents, 45 million, but the net cash outflow from operating activities, 16 million. So they're loss making at the moment. But I've got to say, the sales, though, did ramp up from literally, is it 100 grand or 10 grand? Let me say, 0.1 year. 10 grand in 2019 to 9.4 million. So sales have done pretty well, haven't they? They've gone up, obviously, from a low base. But massive increase there. So obviously there's something in demand there, that their products. So very interesting. Cool. Any other companies?
I looked at Halfords this morning. The Halfords just had results out.
Oh yeah, very interesting.
And I mean, I think, I don't know about you, when I think of Halfords, I just think of these huge warehouses full of everything you need to put on your bike, all the high-vis stuff down to your bike pump, and then maybe you might get your car serviced in Halfords or something.
Yeah.
I think the important thing is, I mean, they've done very, very well over the year. There was a big bike boom. It was one of the only forms of exercise we could get out in our one allocated slot last year. So bikes have been in real boom, but they're really, really trying to diversify this model and become more of a service provider rather than this like pile them high, sell them cheap. Because I think, they've realized that these huge warehouse stores that they have in these business park retail parks, they're costly, and we don't necessarily want to be visiting these things on a Saturday morning. You might go to Pets at Home or TK Maxx and then pop into Halfords or something. We don't necessarily want that, and it's costing them money. So, I think they're doing the right thing. They're fixing the roof when the sun's shining. They've had good results, but they're very, very focused on turning this into a service offering rather than a product offering.
Yeah, do you know what? I literally was... seconds away from pressing the button on investing in this when it was oversold in the dash for cash. I thought, because then it was quite undervalued, I thought. And there's a new CEO turning it around, and he had a strategy in place. And I thought, okay, that's a good sign. I didn't bother in the end. I didn't bother. And then all of a sudden, bike sales went through the roof, and they dash for cash. They hit 50 pence pretty much. They're now £4.12. So that's a nice return there, but I didn't have it. But there we are. It's almost one of the things, it's a no-brainer when you look back now, like I said, bikes. And every time I've been into Halfords, we used to go on bikes quite a lot. They've been very helpful. And I know people prefer smaller sort of independents, but I mean, they've been bought out pretty much. But I mean, honestly, they've been very helpful to me whenever I go into Halfords. Very accommodating. There's obviously a push there to try and get good customer service because they've dropped me. And I've been very polite, very helpful every time I got in there. So good on them. Anything else going on in Dan?
Just one more. I mean, I was just looking at GB Group. I don't know if anyone's heard of them. They're the identity verification firm, and they provide kind of fraud prevention technology. Yeah. I think huge business now, especially with kind of the rise in cybersecurity. Mm-hmm. Especially, you know, we saw Darktrace, the cybersecurity firm, IPO in the UK.
Yeah.
There's a lot of excitement about that. And a few ETFs have sprung up. I think LNG have one, and Rise ETF have another on cybersecurity. But I mean, getting back to like this, I mean, the whole sector is huge. You know, the decent results there. Operating profits up nearly 21% year on year. Mm-hmm. Decent cash position, you know, over 21 million. And that, I mean, that's up from like a debt of 35 million at the start of the year.
That. That's phenomenal. 21 from 35 debt to 21 million cash. Is that this? Yeah, look at that. Profit before tax, 66% up. That's good growth figures there, aren't they? You know?
Absolutely. And I think, do you know, that they're doing the right thing. I mean, in the whole statement, you think this is written by some sort of copywriter in-house, but a lot of the time in this results, when people can have a look at it, you know, the boss, Chris Clark, he made a ton of references to keeping customer engagement scores high, maintaining customers that, you know, business customers that maybe came to them during the pandemic. You know, we were all working online. This kind of business really, really flourishes whenever we all have to work online and we have to start doing more identity checks. So keeping your customers happy and keeping them sticky is extremely important, and it looks like that's what they want to do.
Yeah, yeah. God, do you know what? That Dash for Cash crash back in March was a buy, a big buy. Looking back, you know, obviously the timing would have been hard, but if you bought anything back then, I mean, literally this company has doubled since then, you know, so, but this isn't, it's a, do you know what? The trend is up on this, and it's been up for like, I'm looking at the chart there, from 2000, let's go back 10 years. To 2011, it was 38 pence back then, and now it's close to £9. But it's gone up nice, you know, strong trend. But it's been quite volatile along the way, you know. I'm reading this book at the moment called 100 Baggers, an excellent book about saying that if the business is improving, ignore the share price. You know, so many good investments, people sell because the share price is a bit volatile. But that's the price you pay for better returns in the market. Volatility. That's it. Now, if you ignore the share price and just look at the business, is it operationally and financially improving? Just hold on. And that's why so many people never get 100 baggers because they just sell way too early. You know, many people pick them, but not many people stay in them. You know, so that's the thing. Yeah. It's almost like just have some patience. That's what the market's about, you know. But there we are. Marvellous stuff, Dan, and you know, have a nice weekend, and we'll speak to you next week, Aoife.
Wonderful, Justin. Thanks, you too.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. Here they are. At five, it is Codal Minerals, 18% up to 0.425. At four, Dev Clever Holdings, up 6.62% to 36.25. At three, Mitotech Pharma, down 1.3% to 37.5. At two, Open Orphan, bouncing today, up close to 7% at 32.25. And at one, Hemogenix Pharmaceuticals, up 3.3% to 2.375 pence. Okay, it's time for the top five most read RNSs. They are as follows. At five, Braveheart Investment Group, final results. At four, PetroTal, director PDMR shareholding. At three, Synergin, result of AGM. At two, Argo Blockchain, notice of a post-AGM investor presentation. And at one, Novasight, update on notice of 2020 full year results. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciado.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.